You said you wanted to know how to get Capone. Do you really want to get him? You see what I'm saying? What are you prepared to do?
Everything within the law.
And then what are you prepared to do? If you open the ball on these people, Mr. Nash, you must be prepared to go all the way. Because they won't give up the fight until one of you is dead.
I want to get Capone. I don't know how to get him.
You want to get Capone? Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
So we're going to spend probably about, I don't know, 5 minutes on one of these movies.
Five seconds.
I don't know, 17 hours on the next movie when you consider the prohibition discussion we're going to have in here.
Yeah, I have a full AP history course queued up.
So Mike Auger.
Matt Castro.
Old School Movie Podcast. We're talking about two movies today. One is going to kind of wrap up our discussion last week of Goodfellas. We watched My Blue Heaven from 1990, and then we're going to be covering Untouchables from 1987. So we will start with My Blue Heaven to kind of put a bow on all that.
We're wrapping up Goodfellas. That's the only reason we're doing this.
That's exactly right. So here we go.
When Wilbur will call, and even is night, I hurry to my blue heaven.
My Blue Heaven is really the unofficial sequel to Goodfellas.
I would call it, I'd call it a spiritual sequel, even though it came out before the movie, before Goodfellas came out.
What we mean by that is, it is the second half of Henry Hill's life as a mobster.
Yes.
It's a comedy, though, with Steve Martin, Rick Moranis, Joan Cusack.
And your favorite person from Scrooged, Carol Kane.
Yes. Daniel Stern's in this too, right?
Yeah, for like a minute.
Yeah.
And I think I pointed out that I thought it was funny that Daniel Stern and Joe Pesci, who were both, you know, two halves of the Wet Bandits, also in 1990, starred in these sort of like weird twin universe gangster movies. And like normally it would be very easy to write this off as either a happy accident or just whatever. Yeah. Hollywood makes movies about the same things all the time. But the writer of this movie was Nora Ephron, and she was married to Nicholas Pileggi, who wrote the book that Goodfellas is based on. I think this is pretty easy to see what happened here. So it's the unofficial sequel to Goodfellas.
Yeah, it's so weird how tonally, I mean, they wanted to make this a soft-hearted, like, kid movie. Or not kid movie, I guess, but it's a family comedy.
It's an early 90s family comedy. It has nothing to do with Goodfellas. It has a completely different tone. It's a screwball comedy. I enjoyed this movie. It's fine.
It was made for about $17.
I was going to say, we always do the stats. We'll do this really quickly. Directed by Herbert Ross. Who cares? Written by Nora Ephron. I couldn't even find the budget, but my guess is, I don't know, $25.
Yeah.
It looks like they shot this in a weekend.
Pretty much.
It did gross $23 million, and I'm guessing they made it for significantly less than that, so I'm going to call that a successful movie.
Yeah, and then when we found this out, like, we're like, okay, you know, what was the reception to this? You know, it's 71% critic reviews, 59% audience scores, which is just below the rotten threshold for Rotten Tomatoes.
That's tough.
I don't even know what the other Metacritic and all
they're
that.
They're not good. I looked. They're like significantly lower. I think Metacritic was like 35%.
Yeah, so.
Metacritic's the tough one.
Steve Martin stars as Henry Hill. He's renamed in this.
He's Todd Wilkinson.
Yeah, but even his shoot name is different.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
He's not Henry Hill.
No. Yeah. No, he's really not playing Henry Hill. He's just playing a person that... It's not even he's playing a person that vaguely resembles Henry Hill and the things that he did, because obviously when Henry Hill went into witness protection, he still got himself in all kinds of trouble. And that's the setup for this movie, is Steve Martin's character, who he's playing a vaguely offensive Italian man with an accent that's kind of like his SNL wild and crazy guy accent.
Yep.
He's got a glorious head of Henry Cavill Argyle hair on, fully black.
The biggest thing that cost the most money in this is he got like 12 custom suits made for this. He's in a silk suit every scene.
Okay, I could see that.
But
yeah, he's in like nothing but Armani the whole time. And yeah.
Beyond that, it's like shot in like La Jolla.
Yeah, it's
almost the entire film.
Yeah, there's like no shooting locations of this movie. They go to New York once.
Yeah,
and I don't think you ever actually see New York. You're always just in sets and a hotel room. Whatever. And,
you know, they do hit on some things that are true. Henry Hill did get in a lot of trouble in the witness protection program. There was an FBI agent who was up to his head in frustration because he couldn't keep Henry Hill under wraps.
Yeah.
What they don't show in this is Henry Hill lived a life of fear after the events of Goodfellas, because Jimmy Burke,
I think was his real name. Jimmy the Gent.
So let's just call him Jimmy.
Okay, he's Jimmy.
Behind
De Niro's character
Goodfellas. Was still trying to put hits out on him.
Sure.
And one case got so close that he was like an hour away from being hit. Like, they found him.
Well, okay, but existential dread is bad for your screwball 1990s comedy starring Rick Moranis and Steve Martin. So you can't do that.
Well, they
really
do that in this.
They do, but it's handled so easily. It's like he dispatches two hitmen, and then that's kind of it. Like, he's out of danger. Obviously, that's ridiculous.
Well, the third act goes. I mean, this movie is never really on the rails.
No. Well,
it's fine. It's a fine, enjoyable comedy.
It's the ultimate. It's fine. And I will say, I miss movies like this that are just like super low stakes, kind of silly. You watch them once and you're like, that's enjoyable. And then you just move on.
The third act, they're in the courthouse. The hitmen try to shoot him inside the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
They take off. One of the police women who has been in love with him from the beginning,
despite the fact that he's kind of a dick to everybody,
gives the gun to him and he shoots the guns out of their hands. Then it turns out he funds this little league field. And they're all wearing, like, the jerseys are, like, copies of his suit, and there's a tie and shit.
It's really dumb.
Fucking hilarious, but it's so stupid.
Well,
it's really dumb. You're absolutely right.
I was watching it, and the only thing I could think was, this is so 90s. This
100%.
This is the type of shit that does not get made anymore, and I wish it did, because it's so silly. But it's kind of enjoyable for being so silly.
The best part of this movie, though, is not Steve Martin. It's, to me, it's Rick Moranis and Joan Cusack. I think those two are the highlights of this film.
I agree, because Steve Martin's thing, like, it's funny at first. It's a fun setup, right? It's like the mobster, and he can't...
Wears off quick.
It wears off so fast, and his accent gets really annoying. And he also occasionally will slip out of the accent, and he'll just sound like Steve Martin for a minute.
Yes.
And it's really funny to hear that, too. Like, it's not bad. It's just annoying after a bit. But it is a funny premise. Like, mobster can't keep his nose clean, so hijinks ensue. Like, it's cute. But Rick Moranis is always funny, and I know they paired him with Joan Cusack purely because it's a sight gag. Joan Cusack is 6'7", and Rick Moranis is 4'3", and it's very funny, and I can say that because I'm a short man. It's fine. It's just really funny to watch the two of them merengue.
Yeah, she, like, towers over him.
Towers.
So the movie's fine. Henry Hill, in his later years, like, still getting in trouble, still getting caught trafficking cocaine. Was kicked out of the witness protection program. Now he's like a chef at some shitty rundown bar in Midwest America. And that's it. That's the end of the Henry Hill story.
The Henry Hill story. Wow. Okay. This was fun. I didn't hate it. It was kind of nice. Whatever.
Yeah. We spent more time than I thought we would spend on
that. How much time we spend?
Well, if we count the intro, let's just say 7 minutes.
Okay. We guess 5.
So now we are on to The Untouchables. I can't say the gentleman's name, but we've talked about him many times on this podcast since we've been doing it.
Our old friend Ennio Morricone. I always say Morricone because I'm an American, but I'm almost positive it's Morricone.
He did Scarface too, right?
I believe he did Scarface. He did the movie, the Jack Nicholson Wolf movie, Wolf. He did, I think, something else that we watched. No, he didn't do Scarface because that was like a... That was like a new wave composer that did it. Damn it. I don't know.
The father of disco we spoke of. I'm going to be getting confused.
Yes. But there was another movie that he did, and now I can't. And it was, The Thing. He did The Thing.
Okay.
He's got a really varied, all over the place career. But I knew immediately this was him because in that opening, there is harmonica. And as soon as I heard that, I went, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Got it.
Giorgio Moroder is who did Scarface.
Giorgio Moroder.
Moroder.
Yeah. Yep. That is the guy, the Godfather.
I got confused because it's the same director. This is Brian De Palma directed Untouchables.
Yep. This is our third Brian De Palma film because he also did Mission Impossible 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is really weird that he did Mission Impossible 1, but whatever.
Yeah.
I guess while we're on Morricone, should we just get the music out of the way? What do you think about the music?
It's all over the place.
It's all over. This whole movie's all over the place.
It is.
It's going to be the theme of this movie. It's so all over the place.
And we'll jump around, but...
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, it's fine.
Here's the thing about this movie. It starts out very brutal because a little girl gets a suitcase and she's like, hey, mister, hey, mister. Yeah. And she fucking blows up, but you don't see it.
Yeah, this movie starts with child murder.
And then, like, I would say the violence level and tone is almost like an Indiana Jones.
Yes, it doesn't feel... To me, the whole thing... hate to say it, I kept thinking of Dick Tracy.
Sure.
And also Batman 89, even though this came out before both of those. Yes. Where this is, yes, it's violent, but it's also cartoony.
Whimsical.
Whimsical, including the music.
Yeah.
Very tonally all over the place.
Like this Frontier song you're hearing in the background is in a you would think a violent shootout because they are shooting a bunch of guys, but you don't really see a lot of blood.
No, it's very bloodless.
And then after that point, where they chase everybody down on horseback, this is extremely violent.
Yeah, but this sounds like triumphant. Like
I know
we're going to win the day, and it's like you're just shooting people.
I know,
you're shooting criminals, and I think one of them dies. And
then you're seeing headshots with brain matter flying all over the wall.
Connery point blank, like double taps a guy in the head to prove a point. Like it's meanwhile the music is swelling in the background. It's a weird movie.
And then in the beginning, it's like. Yeah, I was with my gal, and we were going downtown to the diner, and then it's like, hey, motherfucker, get over here, you motherfucker, I'll fucking kill you.
Then a dude gets curb stomped. No, I'm kidding. But like,
but that's the tone.
It's so all over the place. And De Niro is like legit as Al Capone, legitimately, I think, wonderful. I think he's great in the role. Yes. He's genuinely kind of terrifying, but he's also cartoony.
Yes.
It's weird.
And then he starts to get... more gangster, though, as the movie goes on.
Yes.
But he starts out very cartoony.
Yes, very cartoony.
Like a Dick Tracy villain, you're absolutely right.
Well, and even the setting, the Chicago 19... I think this takes place in the late 1920s, early 1930s. This is closer to the end of Prohibition than the beginning. Right. That like the city feels very much like a set, like a stage, very campy, kind of unrealistic. Like, it looks good. It doesn't look bad. It's just there's an unrealism to it that also feels like Tim Burton's Gotham or the Dick Tracy, whatever that city is. It's just what I kept thinking of. Like, this isn't Goodfellas, violent, gritty, brutal, down to earth.
No.
Not this.
Until after the horseback scene.
Yeah, then it becomes a little bit more of a gangster movie, but even some of that, there's a lot of slow-mo.
The Sean Connery death scene is absolutely... I mean, he gets shot 750 times.
Yeah, and he still lives a long...
And he's crawling, and the blood is just everywhere.
Yeah.
And before he dies, he's like... he's coughing up blood. Like, it's brutal.
It's really crazy.
And then Kevin Costner at the end, like, you think he's going to do the right thing and arrest this guy.
Uh-huh.
And then that's the line where...
fucking kills him.
He died like a pig. And he sounded like this, and he was squealing, and Kevin Costner throws him off the fucking roof. Oh, did he sound like that? And the guy goes flying through a car.
Yeah.
Dead.
Which you see. Okay, good. So that was an explosion of our feelings.
Yeah.
Because, yes, this movie, initial thoughts going into this were, this was a total last-minute call. We just wanted to talk more about gangsters. We just liked the gangster talk. It was fun.
Well, here's what happened. We watched My Blue Heaven, and we're texting each other, and we're like, dude, this is not going to cover it. Like,
yeah, like, this is fun, but it's nothing.
Maybe we can mix something in here. And we were throwing around ideas, and I said, how about Untouchables? And Matt's like, well, fuck yeah, I haven't seen that forever.
And I remember loving this movie.
Yeah, let's do it, right?
Yeah.
See, this score here is so different from the Great Frontier City Slickers score you just heard.
Yes.
While they're violently killing people.
Yes. And then there's moments where it transitions to like a love story between Elliot Ness and his wife. Like, it becomes very like romantic.
They're doing the Lord's Prayer and he's sitting there and it's like, doo, doo, doo. And then she's like, why don't you come upstairs and help me brush my hair? I'm like, what? And then all of a sudden they're just killing motherfuckers left and right.
Yeah. It's very strange.
Sean Connery is the absolute best thing in this movie.
For sure.
Absolutely. Hands down.
Before we go any further, should I do our stats?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Untouchables, 1987, as we mentioned, directed by Brian De Palma. I do have to mention that this is written by the celebrated playwright and notorious piece of shit, David Mamet, who has also written one of my other favorite films, A Few Good Men, and obviously tons of plays. And boy, in recent years, has he gotten real not great. But that's all I'm going to say about that. Ennio Morricone doing the score. The guy wrote 100 million soundtracks, I think. Budget for this was $25 million, and the box office was $106 million. And again, only a domestic box office, which, kind of much like Goodfellas, this is such a uniquely American story that I get why this didn't get released overseas. It makes perfect sense.
That's pretty good, though, for those days.
For sure. I mean, yeah. Big-ish, you know, 1987, big-ish budget. You know, Brian De Palma is a big-name director, but he's also very well-known for... He did smaller stuff. Like, he didn't do the huge, big blockbusters for the most part. I mean, his most famous thing was, like, Carrie, which, you know, people love Carrie, but that's, like, a very niche film.
That and Scarface.
Well, yeah, that and Scarface. And I'm sure, because he had already done Scarface at this point, so I have no doubt that that gave him the juice to do things like this. Mm-hmm. You know, I was perusing Kevin Costner's, because obviously everybody else in this is already, like, a star at this point, or at least the leads. This wasn't his first film. He had done some lead work before, but this was definitely the first thing on his IMDb where you'd go, oh yeah, that's the thing that made you a household name.
Kevin Costner has gotten better as an actor as time's gone on.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm not a huge Kevin Costner fan. I don't dislike Kevin Costner, but I always have like Dances with Wolves, and I don't love Field of Dreams. I'm sorry. It's way too schmaltzy for me. So I always have like that in my head with Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys like a Harrison Ford that I think has aged into being a better actor.
Yeah.
However, in this movie, him playing a young, baby-faced idealist, perfect. That's the perfect casting. He's great in that role because that's kind of who he is.
Right, but for me, I don't know. I don't think he's bad in it.
I don't think he's bad
in it, but he's just so outclassed by Sean Connery and Robert De Niro. Like, he cannot hold the floor with them.
Yeah, and even a very young Andy Garcia, who's also in this, doesn't have much to do, but you can tell he's already more of a presence than sure. Kevin Costner is.
Absolutely.
And fortunately, De Niro, I have conflicting thoughts about De Niro's character because I think he's awesome, and I would love to see a feature-length film of just him doing that role, and that's it.
It almost happened.
Did it.
Brian De Palma was going to direct a prequel movie called Untouchables Capone Rising. And apparently that was shit canned.
I hate the name, but I love the idea.
Yeah. Let me get to the reception real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Rotten Tomatoes, 83%. That's critics. Audience, 89. So really good.
Yeah.
Metacritic, 79, which is very high for Metacritic.
Yes.
7.8 on IMDb, so universally acclaimed as well as Goodfellas. Robert De Niro, let's talk about him.
Okay, love it.
He's a method actor, and again, he was obsessively like trying to find everything he can about Capone, getting real life items. He insisted on wearing silk underwear on set, even though they would never be seen on set, just to get into character, because that's what Al Capone used to do.
That's what you think. Just ask some of the interns. Robert De Niro got syphilis just for this role.
There you go. Shit. But yeah, this.
But he's so good. He looks like Al Capone.
Elliot Ness is the main character played by Kevin Costner, and it follows him and how he kind of took down Al Capone. And the thing about this movie kind of tombstoned this.
Oh, yeah.
Or I guess tombstone untouchable themselves because. Here's the thing.
Boy, if you untouchable yourself, you can get in a lot of trouble.
I never like to untouch myself. So, Al Capone never ordered a hit on any of the untouchables, ever. He tried bribing them several times, including the scene where he throws the envelope on the desk. Mm-hmm. Was $1,000 back in those days, which is equivalent to 30 grand. And Elliot Ness did not take that. That is true.
Yeah.
But Elliot Ness hated guns, too.
Yeah, he didn't carry a gun.
Many times he did not carry a gun, and he never shot anybody in his entire life. So this whole cowboys and Indians routine that they show in here, and this mad, like, I don't know, killing spree they go on, like, in they showed in Tombstone.
It's all bullshit.
Yeah.
I would argue that this is much worse. And by the way, that's fine. Movies don't have to be history lessons.
Right.
I'm going to give you one here soon anyway. That's what I'm for. but a movie does not have to be a history lesson. But I just did this. I started looking into the real life story of this movie, and this is as far as I got.
Okay.
Here was my first note. I didn't go too deep into the history of this, which is going to turn out to be a lie, but everything I read essentially just said none of this movie happened, other than Elliot Ness was a person in a law enforcement group called the Untouchables, mm-hmm. who was for sure a pain in Al Capone's ass.
Yes.
And Al Capone was a gangster that ruled Chicago in the 1920s and early 1930s and did go to jail for tax evasion.
Undeniable. That's true.
Other than that, nothing in this movie happened. Elliot Ness was a very small part of taking Al Capone down. The whole tax evasion thing was not his idea. Like I said, he was a pain in his ass. He did break up a lot of their bootlegging operations, and he caused a lot of headaches for him. He never met Capone until Capone was in court. We will get to it.
From what I read, they never even met face to face.
No, they never even met. They didn't meet in the courtroom. They just, like,
he was just there.
He was just there. He just saw him in the courtroom. Yeah. I hate the ending of this movie, but we'll come back to that. But I will say, like, Al Capone got a trial. The ending of this movie is absurd. Al Capone had a full trial.
It is true about the judge switching the juries.
Is it really?
That is true. Yeah.
It shocked. Okay. I mean, it was a
but
different.
But the judge wasn't in the pocket. Like, they try to make it, you know.
Yeah.
He said that he was on that ledger.
Uh-huh.
And that's what kind of made him change his tune. No, the judge was more like out. He was a hard-nosed judge.
Okay.
Didn't want to take no bullshit. Didn't want to accept a plea bargain. Because Al Capone tried to do a plea bargain.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to bribe the jury.
Mm-hmm.
The judge had them switch juries from courtroom to courtroom because of this. So that really did happen.
That's interesting. I obviously, different time, right? This was almost 100 years ago.
Yeah.
These days, that would get the case. Like, jury selection is a part of,
yes.
of a trial.
Yes.
You can't just, the judge can't just be willy-nilly like, new one, please.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure a judge could get a hard-nosed judge and everybody hated Al Capone.
Well, especially on the spot. Like, there would have to be an investigation. And like you said, a reselection would take place.
Yes, exactly.
It would get kicked down the road. Right. Like, those kinds of things
Or it would be
happen.
Declared a mistrial and then you have to start over or whatever. Right. And then the second, I guess we're just talking about the ending now. And then the second bit, his lawyer just goes rogue at the end and says, "He's guilty, Your Honor." And they throw him in jail. Fucking absurd. Obvious, like, absurd on its face. Obviously that would never happen. Your attorney going rogue and just throwing in the towel when your client doesn't want that would be tossed immediately. I thought that was a terrible, I don't like the ending to this movie at all. I think it feels rushed. I would even say something that I normally don't ever say, which is that I wish this movie was longer. It's 2 hours, but if you're going to cover something like taking down Al Capone in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Give it some breathing room. Don't rush so much.
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
Okay.
You know who was originally up for the role of Elliot Ness?
I had heard Jack Nicholson.
Mm-mm.
No. Okay. So who?
Don Johnson.
I could totally see that.
Yeah. He turned the role down.
Hell yeah. And you know what? I would want him in his Miami Vice suits, not 1930s suits. I want to see nothing but silk, big collars, and unbuttoned down to your belly button.
Marlon Brando was also cast as Al Capone, or he was offered $5 million for 2 weeks of filming, holy and he shit. Turned it down.
Yeah, Marlon Brando is such a nut.
And then Robert De Niro took over. So
I think that would also be really good casting. Boy, though, man, 1987 Marlon Brando was not 1970 Marlon Brando.
Also, there's a different ending planned for the movie.
Oh, was it
initially?
Better?
It was going to be this big shootout. Well, there's two things. The train station scene was going to escalate on top of a train.
Oh, I like that way better.
So they didn't have the budget for that, so they cut that out.
That's a shame.
Even though I think the bus train scene is pretty intense. There's a slow motion scene of a baby in a baby buggy, like, going down the steps with all these gangsters shooting the fuck out of each other.
Yeah, that's if I remember correctly, I didn't write it down, I should have. I think that's an homage to Battleship Potemkin, which is a 1920s silent film, I want to say, German film.
Yeah.
That were like that staircase scene. It's been done a million times. We've all seen a slow-mo staircase scene or something like that.
Maybe not with so much brain matter being sprayed against the wall.
Probably with less brain matter.
I cannot fucking believe we've said it enough, but the first half of this movie feels like Indiana Jones.
Yeah, and like, then it gets gory and bloody.
And then there's brain matter and F-bombs every 2 seconds, like, out of nowhere.
Well, you kind of mentioned it. Yeah, you're right. You kind of mentioned it that, like, there's a turning point. It's when they're doing a bust between the U.S. and the Canadian border. They're with Canadian Mounties on horseback, and they're hiding out. And Elliot Ness's character kills a guy, and he's conflicted about it. And Connery's character is just like, well, you're going home to see your wife and family tonight, and so that's all that matters. Good job. And then they go to interrogate a guy, and to make him talk, Connery walks out, takes the dead body. The guy being interrogated doesn't know he's dead, and Connery shoots him in the head.
Yeah,
through the window.
And you see brain matter everywhere, just fly on the fucking table.
And from that moment on, the movie gets significantly bloodier.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, this is 87. Even today, you're still only allowed a certain amount of blood. So maybe they were trying to avoid the X rating and save it for the end.
They maximize headshots in this for sure.
Yeah.
Multiple people get shot right through the head. Mm-hmm. And their brain is exploded on the back of a wall.
Yeah.
We gotta talk about Sean Connery.
He's the best part of the movie.
This is the only Oscar he won. He made 75 movies.
Yeah. Now, in fairness, a lot of the 75 were not going to be Oscar.
Are you telling me he wasn't Oscar worthy in The Rock or The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Maybe The Rock. Maybe The Rock.
Or any of the Bond movies?
Winners fuck the prom queen.
Yes.
Okay, I'd like to talk about that for a minute, because now that we've mentioned Bond.
Here we go.
Yeah, everybody get comfortable. It is always so weird for me to watch a non-James Bond movie with Sean Connery, because I love Sean Connery in Bond. He's my favorite Bond. I think he's the best Bond. I don't see him ever being topped. But Sean Connery started to hate the Bond series pretty much immediately. It made him a huge star, but he always considered himself to be an actor. And obviously the money was good and he was a megastar, and it afforded him opportunities for the rest of his life. But he never really liked the role. He was just so naturally good at it that even when he was phoning it in, which, if we're being honest, he was a lot, he was still excellent. But then you see him in a movie where he's really trying, and you're like, oh yeah, that guy is a great actor. I understand why he felt that way.
Yeah.
But it's still weird to me, because I always feel like I'm watching two different people. That's all. But he's great in this.
It was his idea to do the blood oath scene in a Catholic church. Connery's.
Yeah, it works. It's good.
They were going to do it in the street, and he suggested that they do it in the church. And another thing that I saw that I just thought was hilarious, which I'm just going to read because I don't know if I can do it justice.
Okay.
Says, Sir Sean Connery turned up to the shoot in his golf clothes. They did a close-up, and Sean was dismissed for the day. Andy Garcia and Charles Martin Smith grabbed him after the scene and said, that was very clever of you. You just got back from golf, turn up for 5 minutes, and do your scene, and that's it. Connery turned to them and said, this is not my first barbecue. What a fucking pro, dude.
That's so good. He got obsessed with golf during Goldfinger. You know, they do the famous golf scene with him, and he got really obsessed specifically with Lynx golf, which is a specific type of Scottish golf. I think he owned a golf course at one point. He got obsessed with it and never got unobsessed. Samuel L. Jackson did the same thing. I think it's still in his contract for all the movies he does, but I know he for sure did this during all the Star Wars movies, where one of his stipulations was wherever he shoots, he has to be enrolled as a member in the local country club.
Is that right?
Yeah, and he kind of pulled the same thing where he was like, I'm big enough where I'm going to roll up, I'll do my bit. Bye, off to the club.
That's great.
I love it.
Let's talk about the dinner scene. Al Capone is not happy because there was a raid.
No.
And we'll get to his whole gimmick here and the premise of this whole movie here real quick. That really happened.
Yes.
But I guess instead of it was one guy, he bashed like four dudes' brains in.
It was three or four, and he found out they were conspiring against him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we actually get a reason for why he does this in this movie.
That the guy that he kills was there. He's the one that got busted when they first do the raid. He got kicked in the balls by Sean Connery.
All right, got it.
Yeah. So, but again, they don't really show it. It's kind of off screen, and then you just see a little bit of blood dribble.
It's effective enough. The implication is
But
there.
It doesn't go to the heights that this movie goes to later on, is my point.
No. If this were a Tarantino movie or just shot 10 years later, you'd probably be a lot bloodier throughout, because they do rein it in the beginning.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about Prohibition here. Al Capone is bootlegging booze because Prohibition has taken place. I believe it started in 1918, correct?
1920.
1920, okay.
1920 to 1933. Okay, should I just dive into my Prohibition
bit? Yeah, go ahead.
I did so much reading about Prohibition just today. I did not mean to. I started down a little rabbit hole, mm-hmm. and oh boy, did that rabbit hole get deeper. So I just wrote this because, in school, at least I was taught, it was 15 years ago now, but it's probably still very much the same. I was taught that Prohibition was a sort of moral panic that kind of came out of nowhere and eventually did way more harm to the country than it ever did good. And I'm not so sure about that. And the whole image of, Prohibition happened because Carrie Nation and a bunch of old ladies smashed up beer barrels, and next thing you know, alcohol was illegal. Like, it's a cute story, but it's not true at all. That part is true, but it's so much more complex. And it's fascinating that America, a country that really loves liquor, still, ever, willingly, overwhelmingly gave up booze. So how did it happen? And I'm going to do this because if anybody hears this and learns something, then I'll feel like I've done my job. And also, things are always more complicated than they seem.
Yeah.
Okay, so this movie picks up in 1930. We're closer to the end of Prohibition than we are than to the beginning. And the end of Prohibition is equally as interesting, but it's kind of less complex. Basically, a lot of different people, for many different reasons, come to this conclusion that this is fucking stupid. Like, what are we doing here? We're giving organized crime a leg up. People love booze. They're still drinking. This is doing nothing. Even women, which overwhelmingly supported Prohibition in the first place, felt that with so many people ignoring a law, that maybe law at some point just in general would become looked down upon, that we were sort of desensitizing people to just not follow the law and it was fine.
Well, in the beginning of this movie, when Elliot Ness takes over, he does tell all the police, like, I know some of you got the drink.
Yep.
Before I was here is whatever, but none of you can drink after this. And you can see that a lot of the police, they don't like that at all. They don't agree with that. And I mean, some of them are on the take too, so.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned the police yet, but they're basically all in on the grift.
Yeah, the reason why he recruits Sean Connery is because he's a beat cop. He kind of finds him to be honest. He tells him, are you going home tonight? He goes, yeah. And he goes, that's the first rule of police work is mm-hmm. going home alive.
Yep.
You know,
that's his whole outlook is, yeah. Keep yourself alive. And he finally, opens up and says, well, why do you think I'm a beat cop at this age? It was more important to me to stay alive. And I just didn't want to get involved with any of that stuff. So,
right.
Whatever.
So, yeah. So getting back to Prohibition.
So by the time Prohibition rolls around in 1920, the temperance movement had been growing in America since at least the early 1800s, probably about 1820. So that's not that long after the Revolution. But alcohol has always been a huge part of America. The rum trade was a thing. America, thank you. Oh, there's going to be a lot of Americas in this, because this story is so quintessentially American. But alcohol had always been a big part of America, and distilled spirits, at least on an industrial level, were still extremely new. So people were getting drunk in quicker, cheaper, and more exciting ways than they ever had been in human history, because before that it was just beer and wine. So this is a little bit different. The temperance movement was largely led by women. This is probably the first major feminist movement. Just these ladies trying to take away our fun. That's what I'm saying. but it is absolutely true that America was just too damn drunk. And like, when I say too drunk, our drinking rates in America are still very high today, but like, I cannot overemphasize how much people, and in particular men, because men were the only people that were let into saloons at the time, were drinking. Like, drinking was everywhere. As more society moved to urban areas, saloons had popped up like crazy. They were on every corner. They were often bankrolled and supported by a single brewery, as that was the brewery's way of driving revenue, because the local liquor store, that wasn't really a thing. Worst times. And drinking culture was completely out of control, Because obviously, like I said, only men could be in saloons and bars, pubs, whatever at this time. Women were not allowed. Just the good old days.
Why do you expect a woman to be in a bar when there's also running a brothel out of there too?
That's a good point. You got to think about being respectful.
There was probably a lot more of those though back in those days, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
We're kind of tied in.
I can't confidently say. I know that was like an old West thing, right? Where you have a drink and a roll in the hay and you got a place to stay for the night. It was sort of all in one.
All for a nickel.
I genuinely don't know. It didn't come up in stuff I was reading, but I'll find out because I'm kind of curious.
Oh, yeah. But anyhow.
Just as an example of how prolific liquor was and how accepted it was, the Old Fashioned, which we now consider to be a pretty boozy cocktail. It will fuck you up. It is my favorite cocktail. Around that time, that would have been seen as a breakfast drink. It was seen as a sort of tonic, as a way to start your day and really liven you up.
Well, it's you know that one YouTube channel I told you about where it was like they do all these meals from this period and a little bit before then.
Oh, yeah.
They said like they would get up and just like drink a beer, and that's their breakfast for the day.
Yeah. So the idea of having coffee or tea in the morning is a post-prohibition thing. Before that, you just drank whatever, whenever.
Okay.
Maybe you had it in the morning, maybe you had it at night, didn't matter. You were drunk, so the caffeine wasn't going to keep you up.
Right.
Like, people were hammered. There was no entertainment. There was no TV, there was very little radio. Sporting events and plays were very expensive. Saloons became entertainment. They were a gathering place for people. They were a stress reliever during a, you know, very brutal time to be alive, because we're mostly talking here about the working class, people who are in factories.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, let's be real. Nothing's changed today, right? You have a hard week. You want to go to the bar with your friends. God knows we like to do that.
100%.
And so at this point, being in a state of semi-drunkenness, or at least men being in a state of semi-drunkenness, was just acceptable. I am going to speculate here, because when Prohibition did roll around, there were plenty of industrialists that were in favor of it as a way to increase productivity in the workplace. I kind of think that the powers that be in this case did not hate a semi-inebriated workforce.
Okay.
There was very little, if any, workplace safety laws, and if they did sober up, they might figure out that they could unionize, and nobody wanted that. So bosses just putting up with drunk people, I think that just kind of was a risk they were willing to take.
Mm-hmm.
It also was not uncommon for men to be able to get a bowl of soup or a sandwich that came with their beer for free. All of which is to say that drinking, being in a saloon, bar culture, it didn't seem like an accident, and it was almost a must if you were a man because you had nothing else to do. Immigrants. Saloons were especially attractive to immigrants for all the reasons that we just mentioned, but also because if you were new here, if you were literally fresh off the boat off Ellis Island, you probably found a community in a saloon, maybe even of people that came from the same place you did, and so it gave you people to talk to. These immigrants also sort of learned how to be American and participate politically, and this is going to become very relevant here in a minute.
Okay.
Women, I think understandably, were very sick of men in their life either being drunk all the time or dying at alarming rates. At this point, 30% of men had cirrhosis of the liver.
Holy shit.
Absolutely insane.
And you got to be a fucking booze hound to get that.
Yes, I'm working on it.
Yeah.
It obviously goes without saying that domestic violence was a huge problem. Men coming home shithoused, beating their wife, beating their kids, beating their, you know, female relatives was rampant. And if nothing else, women were just fed up with their husbands drinking away their day's pay. So given all of that, it is not insane to say that the idea of alcohol as a huge problem in the country was spreading quickly. America was also at this point becoming even more religious, if you can believe that. And people were starting to feel like modern times were just around the corner and maybe alcohol belonged in the past. Having said that, this was never going to get national traction because this movement was mostly women and very religious men. Women have no power. They don't have the right to vote. So the men, they like the booze. They're just going to ignore them for now.
It was a simpler time.
It was a better time.
We're kidding.
Yeah, we don't think this is a bad time. This is a fucked up time, to be clear. Like, people who say we need to go back to better days, genuinely give me a time period and I will tell you why you're wrong. Anyway, so how did Prohibition actually come to be? Well, tale as old as time. Racism and xenophobia. Just as a fun note, the KKK was very much in support of the Anti-Saloon League at the time, because basically all of their least favorite people were being targeted by Prohibition efforts. immigrants, Catholics, Italians, the Irish, and black people.
All this information was sourced by UC Berkeley. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I found this. I read so many different things.
I'm fucking busted.
No. This is 100% true. No. Actually, some of this came from, believe it or not, some of this came from a wine magazine.
Really?
Yeah, some of this came from, I want to say Oxford was a source. I mean, good old Wikipedia is always a good place to start. But no, I was all over the place. I even went down a rabbit hole of reading... we're going to get to the immigration bit here in a second, but I even went down a rabbit hole of reading anti-immigrant drinking propaganda, like posters that would go up.
No shit.
Oh my God, man. Some of those are deeply uncomfortable.
Well, all the Trump supporters have now left this podcast.
Everyone's left the podcast, but you guys, this is, I'm sorry. This is history. This is facts.
No,
this
I love
how,
it.
This is how we got here. And it's about to get much worse.
Oh boy. Strap in.
The 1906 Atlanta race riots was the turning point for prohibition. There was a never-to-this-day substantiated report of black men sexually assaulting white women and were reported in a newspaper, which got international coverage, not just
what year was this?
This is 1906.
Okay.
So we're still well before prohibition, but this is like...
The wheels are turning.
The wheels are very much turning, and the time period that I was just describing, like the everybody's fucking plastered all the time period, that would have been more like late 1800s.
Okay.
And drinking around then wasn't just, you know, saloons and taverns. That was also the golden age of cocktails. I've read a book on this once, and it's fascinating. Like, we've lost so much of cocktails that were made then.
I'm curious, what was the alcohol percentages of beer back then? Do you know?
Of beer?
Is there an estimate, or...
Yeah, I mean, I think they were pretty much... I mean, okay, like, IPAs weren't really a thing. So right. The shit that you and I love didn't really exist.
It was like darker beers?
It would have been darker beers, lagers, ales, amber. I mean, it's the same stuff we drink today.
Okay.
Beer was, from what I understand, beer was pretty modern at that point. Hops were a thing, but not hoppy, not super hoppy beers like we drink. It would have been the more traditional styles of beer. But that stuff goes back hundreds of years. So it still would have been 4, 5, 6% probably.
Okay.
Probably not too much higher than
that. No triple IPAs?
I mean, see, like I said, worst times. We couldn't drink El Segundo Power Plant at 14%.
You know, IPAs, I'm not even sure how popular those really are compared to like the broader American society. Because a lot of like, especially they're older people, like our parents' age.
They don't drink that shit
at all, dude. They're Bud Light or fucking Coors or whatever.
My dad rarely drinks beer, but if I gave him an IPA, he would ask me when I became a communist.
Yeah, my parents hate IPAs. My dad, I gave him a Broken Skull one. Mm. He tried it and was like, oh, fuck that. After one drink.
Yeah. And you're like, well, give it back then.
Yeah, exactly.
IPAs as a concept, like, I think they've been around for a while, but I mean, the craft beer thing really didn't break out until the 90s. So like for our parents, they had already committed to Bud or Coors or whatever by then. And they don't look at that as beer.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think beer was like mostly normal and spirits were... In some case, even higher proof than they are today.
Shit.
Gin, I think, had a higher proof point. Cognac had a higher proof point. So, spirits, like, this was modern. Like, if you got in a time machine and went back to 1900 to drink, you would not be out of place at all. We basically drink the same shit now. But let's go back to something happier, the Atlanta race riots.
Yeah.
So, unsubstantiated reports of black men assaulting white women. We have heard this story many times. A mob of white men descend on Atlanta and wreak havoc for several days. They end up killing somewhere between 20 and 45 black men. Atlanta at this point was supposed to be like a shining example of the New South. Mm-hmm. And it really put a damper on that. And even white Georgia officials were not happy with this because they didn't want to be looked at that way. This got a ton of attention. Mm-hmm. And that story is way crazier. That could be its own thing. The reports, which were wrong, this was never proven, there was no evidence of this, was that this whole thing started because the black men that initiated the attacks were drinking. They were at saloons. And it was just yet another example of bad drunken behavior. Obviously, there's a lot more going on there than that, but that idea started to get in people's heads, and there were some other incidents like this where fights would break out, especially in the South.
So these claims were just... unsubstantiated.
Yeah, they were never...
Nobody knows if they're true or not.
No, but they're almost certainly not true.
Why is that?
Because there was never any evidence. There was no eyewitnesses. And this sort of thing happened all the time in the South.
Well, it certainly doesn't... Okay. even if these gentlemen or whatever are accused of such a thing, it doesn't justify going there and killing 50.
That's a great point.
You know what I mean?
You are correct.
Like every, like in America, you all have your due court date.
Yes.
Even Al Capone had his.
Yes.
Not to tie back to this.
Not like that BS in the movie. Yeah. He had an actual trial.
Exactly.
Yes. But no, you are totally right. I mean, every source I could find, I genuinely tried to find out more about this.
Yeah.
The trial of these men, because four men did get tried and they were convicted. But
oh, okay.
Again, this happened all the time.
Right.
I mean, it was the famous Emmett Till thing. That was only in the 50s of cute black, you know, accusing a black kid of rape.
I mean, obviously, we're not going to be here for 5 hours, but
no, we could do this all night long.
I don't know if they found, you know, I don't know shit about like this case or these four people that were convicted, what kind of evidence they had, if they had any, if they just said, you're black, you're going to jail.
Yeah.
Who fucking knows? But it still doesn't justify ultimately what happened.
Yeah, that's a great point, is even if they were guilty, you still can't go ransack a city and kill people.
Yeah, like, even
that's
if all bad. Four guys that happen to be black are guilty, yeah. You kill like 50 black people because of this? Like,
It's really hard to find anything about this case. Because the state of Georgia pretty much buries it for a long time. Yeah. It wasn't until the 100-year anniversary, 2006, that they actually finally started like finding more information on this.
Yeah.
So I genuinely did try to find more, but
sure.
As far as the historical record is concerned, unsubstantiated claims.
It's tough too, because back in those days, like, not everybody had an iPhone out, and you know, you basically see everything happen in real time these days.
Sure. Sure, but like there were still transcripts of court cases and things. Those things were all kept in record. So it's just genuinely hard to find. Anyway, that's not really the point. The point is that was the moment where
it changed.
A major state like Georgia, because states were already dry at this point, but look, there were states like Kansas, where it was kind of like it was always part of their culture. It was very like rural, very conservative, very religious. And then you had a little bit more of a metropolitan state like Georgia, who said, okay, we don't like this. And that spread very quickly throughout the South.
Okay.
And indeed, by the time Prohibition did roll around, almost the entirety of the South was dry by law. So Prohibition wasn't that crazy for them. By 1915, the Prohibition movement had already tied itself to more anti-immigrant sentiment, because they figured if you were actually going to make this law, you had to figure out a way to... Look, you had to find a villain. This is what we do. If you're going to make something move, you got to find somebody to hate. And it is true that immigrants drank probably more than, you know, the Americans who were here, because in Europe, there was a much more permissive drinking culture. So that is true. Drinking was already being painted as something that the filthy Irish Catholic, I can say that because I am Irish.
Well, I was told that beer is an American invention, Matt.
It is indeed not. that's about to become very relevant here in a second. And they really went hard on Catholics. This is sort of one of those things that's been forgotten in history, but we kind of mentioned this in our Exorcist episode, but the Catholics were like, you know, almost societal outcasts until like the 1950s.
Do you think that has to do with the, because I know the Irish, like back in the days in this country, were definitely second-class citizens.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very, those two things are closely tied together.
Irish Catholic?
Yeah.
Certainly could be. I think also the Catholic religion was just looked at as kind of weird. Which they are, but the drinking, we're not arguing.
Yeah.
You know, the literal drinking of the blood, the eating of the body, that was kind of a big deal that rubbed people the wrong way. They were seen as almost like cultish. So no, it bothered a lot of people. Anyway, enough about my Catholic stuff.
Let's see how many different audiences we can chase away today.
Look, this is history, y'all. History is not pretty.
Fuck it. My opinions are my opinions, and yours are yours. Fuck off.
These are not opinions.
No, I'm talking about saying Catholics are weird.
Oh well, that's all right. Well, you know. So to go back to where beer probably was created, or at least became most successful, World War I, rolled around, and I think World War I is almost certainly what seals the deal here. Another fun fact that I came across, Americans during World War I started calling sauerkraut Liberty Cabbage, just in...
Unfucking real.
Example like, number 1,020,000 that nothing ever changes.
Yeah, freedom fries,
exactly,
anybody?
Exactly. We have literally always done the same shit. Like,
it's fucking awesome.
I came across so many anecdotes in this whole story where I'm like, God, nothing has changed. Things have changed, to be clear. Things have gotten much, much better. Okay.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Let's be very clear about that. I don't think human nature changes, and we always make a lot of the same mistakes, but like just the horrifying shit that was going on around this time, That has objectively gotten better. I just want to be clear about that.
Sure.
Also, World War I is against the Germans, not for the last time. So what is very heavily tied to Germany? Beer. And now there's a common enemy. People hate the Germans. This is specifically after the sinking of the Lusitania. This was in like 1915. This all kind of starts to pop up. The U.S. doesn't get into the war for another 2 years. But that really solidifies the, if you drink beer, you're supporting Germany.
Right.
And that takes a huge dent out of the U.S. liquor market. So at the end of 1919, a wartime prohibition goes into effect. That was explicitly to save grain for the war effort. But where we're heading is already pretty obvious. Like, we have a common enemy in Germans, immigrants, lots of people that lots of people in this country don't like for a variety of reasons. America has genuinely been just way too drunk for a very long time. 26 states in total were dry by this point, by 1919. And that's not counting dry counties and wet states. Immigrants are getting a little too comfortable voting, and we can't possibly have that. We got the Germans to hate. So you put all of this together, and it's just not that crazy that we got to prohibition. It seems insane now, but in the moment, it made way more sense. And one like last note on how we got there, President Wilson actually vetoed the Volstead Act, which really created the enforcement for prohibition. And Congress was able to override his veto, which is really hard to do. So it was overwhelmingly popular.
Okay.
So we get there. That's prohibition. That's kind of how we got to that moment. There is so much more that we could talk about, but I'll be done. The only thing I'll also add is did it work? Because that's the thing we always hear is prohibition was just a disaster. It gave way to organized crime. It didn't do any good. People still drink, whatever, blah, blah, blah. The answer is, yeah, it kind of did work, because if your intent was to get people to drink less, it did. Like, for instance, the cirrhosis levels that I mentioned earlier went way down post-prohibition. The culture has never gone back to drinking that much ever. It did save lives. It did bring down domestic violence, et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of did. Basically, America did a dry January, and they made healthier habits after that. Mm. And even in regards to the crime, some historians now argue that the crime levels during prohibition did not actually go up at all. They were just a little more obvious because more people were engaging in a criminal activity, which was drinking. But that crime was always there. People just didn't see it as much.
Yeah. So that led way to the rise of Al Capone, which he went to like a boarding school. He slugged a teacher. They wanted to expel him and send him to some kind of strict military school. He dropped out of school at that point and kind of got involved in the mob, similar to Goodfellas, like at a young age.
Oh, you mean they're not all college graduates?
Yeah, not really.
I'm surprised.
He did marry a woman, I think, and was trying to like support her. And he found the best way to do that was like to get involved in the mob. He got the scar on his face from a brothel. I think somebody stabbed him in the face. And then once Prohibition came in and the mob like really got involved in that and were just making money hand over fist, that's when he kind of rose to prominence. Spent a lot of his time taking out other rivals and things like that, and he had, at first there was like a truce with another gang in Chicago where he had his territory and that gang had theirs.
Yeah, I think it was this. He had the South and they had the North. And yeah, there was this unspoken. This is, you mentioned this to me the other day, but this is basically the first Scarface movie, the 1930s one.
Yes.
And he starts, so he picks a fight with the North and successfully takes over territory.
Exactly. The real Scarface, they really started hammering down on him over the years. He was in and out of jail for different things. They followed him around, followed him to Florida. He got syphilis from a brothel, it went into his brain. And they said he basically had the mind of like a toddler towards the end of his life. And he ended up passing away kind of in a shitty way. So
he passed away young too, right? Like he was maybe not even 50.
Elliot Ness passed away at 54.
Oh, that's okay. That's right.
And I want to talk about him too, because this movie portrays him as this loving family man with two children. In reality, Elliot Ness has been married 3 times. He had one child that was adopted. He never even had his own children. Was a heavy chain smoker. After Prohibition, became a massive alcoholic.
That's funny.
And he dropped dead of a heart attack at 54 years old.
Jeez. Apparently, the alcoholism, I didn't go too deep into this, but apparently the alcoholism was a result of a really embarrassing scandal. I don't remember. It was something to do with police work gone wrong. like he was after a killer or something like that that he couldn't get, that was taunting him, and it was like it drove him insane.
Is that where he got pictured with the umbrella?
I don't know, actually.
Because they show that in this movie at first. And that's what we're talking about. It's like Dick Tracy, Whimsical.
Yeah, okay, sure.
The guy's there with the big camera and like...
Yeah.
It's all played up for yucks.
He loved the press. That is one thing I did read about him. That like the myth of Elliot Ness is largely played up because he played it up himself. He
Wyatt Earp.
He was a fabulist. Yes, exactly like Wyatt Earp. He knew how to tell a tale, and there was a great quote I read when the modern ATF, which is kind of what he was part of, but you know, before it was that, they apparently have one of their main buildings in Washington, D.C. named after him. And somebody was quoted at the time saying, like, you might as well have named this after Superman. Like, that's how accurate this is. Like, this is crazy. This guy didn't do any of this stuff. But he had become such a legend in his own right that they just sort of, the ATF now just like leans into it because everybody knows who he is.
Yeah, and a lot of the shit, I mean, didn't really happen. Like, Sean Connery didn't get shot 785 times by a machine gun and live another, like, 7 hours.
Yeah, live long enough to deliver several very important messages. Yeah, that moves the plot along.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only surviving member, though, when this movie was made was, I believe, the character Andy Garcia plays. And he lent his guidance on set. He was a consultant. And he spoke to Robert De Niro in great length because, as we talked about, De Niro's always trying to like get the perfect portrayal of the character he's playing. So, and the last thing I really want to say about this is this movie was made because Paramount had the rights to this story and they were running out of the rights to it.
That's the same reason they made Dick Tracy.
Yeah, well, it's the same shit here. So,
or I guess that's the same reason what's-his-name made Dick Tracy, because he had the rights and he had to use them.
It's incredible that they made such a highly regarded movie out of those reasons, because a lot of times when studios make movies for that reason... The movie turns out to be shit.
Yeah, you get the 1990s Fantastic Four. Yeah,
or Morbius or something like that, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
to coin a modern phrase or a modern movie.
Oh, sorry.
It was not Morbin time for this movie.
No, it was not.
Yeah.
No, this movie was very good. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you're right. Normally, if a studio is just trying to hold on to something, it's like a desperate cash grab that they make for $8.
Yeah. This movie's fucking crazy. Like... Again, we spoke at great length in the beginning of this about the tone. It's just, I mean, like you said, it feels like 10 different movies, kind of.
It does feel like 10 different movies to varying degrees of quality. I will admit, when Connery exits the movie, my interest does wane a little bit.
I agree.
I was kind of like, all right, well, yeah, it's not as good. Mm-hmm. It does kind of feel like in moments they ran out of ideas. A shootout on the top of a courthouse... to end your movie with and turning, like trying to turn it into really personal stakes. You killed my friend that I knew for 2 weeks. It did feel rushed. I wish they would have let it breathe a little bit. There are a lot of odd choices made. Having said that, I really like this movie. I would watch it again in a heartbeat. It's fun as hell and it's weird.
I'm with you on the rooftop scene until
he throws him into a car.
Yes.
Okay.
The reason why, because like a lot of movies do this where the hero kills 785 people and for some reason they're like, not today.
Yeah,
I'm not stooping down to your level. You're going to jail.
Yeah.
And instead he's just like, nope, fucking fly, piggy.
Yeah.
throw some right off the roof. You know?
Yeah, I agree with you. I always hate you. I do always hate it. It's like, this is the one I'm going to let go. I've learned my lesson.
And I love how he brutally murders him and then just goes and sits back down in the courthouse.
Oh, he had a great line, too. It was like a Bond line. When somebody asked him where he is, he's like, he said, he's in the car. And I was like, that's a great line. That's a Pierce Brosnan line.
What was the other line you texted me that Sean Connery said?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, wait a minute. Hang on.
Yeah, pull it up.
It was, they were discussing corruption.
Yeah.
And God, we send each other a lot of texts.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay.
This was the first like big great Connery line from the movie where I went, oh yeah, we're gonna get some all timers out of this guy. He said, "This town stinks like a whorehouse at low tide." Very good. Very, very good.
Yeah, so
it's like only Connery can deliver those lines too.
And to watch this movie for just Sean Connery alone.
Worth it.
Is worth it.
Yeah.
You know, I do agree. When he exits the film, I'm like, no, Please no.
Yeah, it does. It does get noticeably worse, but, you know, character stakes and whatever.
Yeah.
You feel it when they kill the accountant, too. We didn't really talk about him. He's on the team, but he's the accountant.
He's another guy that gets his brain splattered against the elevator.
Yeah, that's another bloody scene.
Oh, yeah.
But you kind of feel for that guy because you're like, well, he's not a...
He just kind of got dragged into this.
He's an accountant.
Yeah.
And they were just like, you carry a badge? Yeah, well, now you carry a gun. That's not how that works.
He's like one of the main guys that took down Capone, too. It wasn't, you know, breaking down doors and cracking skulls. It was accountants like tying him to tax fraud.
Absolutely. Like, that's what really did it. And the real idea behind that, you know, wasn't just, oh, we can get him for tax fraud. Their actual thought process was juries drink. And they like this guy. Capone was popular.
Oh, yeah. He was like a celebrity.
Yes. Yeah. He was until the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Yeah. That was the turning point where they went, oh, this guy's actually a lunatic.
Yes. Then they started to turn against him.
Yeah. But up to that point, they really liked Capone. And I think they did a good job showing that in this movie where he's kind of like, he's playing with the press. They're kind of laughing at him.
Yeah.
He goes to an opera. He's like, you know, he's rubbing elbows with the elite. And they really like him. He did a lot of charity work. So their whole thing was, well, the jury likes to drink. They don't view this as a crime, and they kind of like him still. But you know what they don't like? People who cheat on their taxes.
Well, and the whole thing about him having the mayor in his back pocket when he had that little note, to whom it may concern, when he had that gun, hit one of his henchmen, that's real. He did really have the mayor of Chicago in his back pocket, too. So, again, prohibition is a fucked up, like...
Chicago has not had a good mayor in mess of like a thing. 140 years.
Chicago. I mean, you know, it's got... This is one thing that gun pundits will always throw out, but it's true. Chicago does have some pretty strict gun laws.
Well, I can tell you... Oh, I'm not going to get into this right now. There's a reason Chicago has so many guns, and it's not what you think.
We won't go there because we're not going to do another hour.
We're not going to go there.
But they still have a lot of gun violence to this day.
Tons. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, Chicago, well, it's still a pretty crazy city.
Chicago has had a massive crime problem since, when was Chicago created?
Yeah.
That day. That is undeniably true.
Yeah.
And they have, and yes, it is true. They have very strict laws, but they also still have tons of crime and tons of corruption. And it's something about that city. I don't know what it is. I mean, Chicago was a really... Okay, last little weird tidbit. Chicago's a really interesting town because it was one of the first, like, planned corporate towns in America. And it's just always had that air of everybody being in everybody else's pocket since day one.
Mm.
It's never had a point where it was, like, clean.
Gotcha.
New York has kind of gone in and out of that. Like, they've had some really bad times. They've had some really good times. You know, LA is kind of a relatively modern city. But kind of the same thing.
LA is a shithole.
LA is a shithole.
I've been there recently. Yeah. I don't know if you have.
Within the last year or so.
Yeah, it's fucking terrible.
No, it's awful.
Chicago,
though, has just always had that aura to it.
But the big thing with LA right now is homeless. I mean,
yeah.
As far as the optics go.
Very much so. Well, I mean, it's a fact. I mean, you go out there and you can't deny it.
No, not at all. But yeah, sometimes, too, with these bigger cities, you're going to have bigger problems. Just the way it is.
That's absolutely true. And you'll go in and out of periods of having problems, like much like New York. I mean, New York, especially in the 90s, was a shithole.
Yep.
And just watch Home Alone 2. It's a documentary.
And the mob was a big problem.
A huge problem. And now they've cleaned it up tremendously.
Right.
So it's possible. Right. I mean, but you're absolutely right. Those big cities will always have, and we live in relatively big cities. We're not recording from a place where we're going to say, like, oh, all the big cities are bad. Like, no, there's good, too. But they definitely have their problems.
Sure.
You know, it's funny. The last people still listening to this were in Chicago, and they just turned it off. It's like, fuck those guys.
Well, we pretty much shit on everybody we possibly can and offended everybody.
Over a relatively silly movie.
Yeah.
But it was fun. Whatever.
I think we've done our job here.
I think so, too.
So that's it for this week. Next week, we're doing something a little bit different. And we'll get into that next week. But for now, follow us Instagram. I got to start posting on there again.
Yeah, tune in next week's for our chat on Nazism.
Yeah.
And abortion.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Abortion, religion, and Donald Trump.
Yeah. Ooh, so fun.
Yeah. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.